It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
The University of Washington became the nation's first large college to close its classrooms, saying it will cancel in-person classes and have students take classes and exams remotely instead.
Stanford and Harvard, they're canceling classes or they're going to online learning, not just for a couple of weeks, but for the rest of the year.
Around the world, communities are taking drastic measures to curtail the spread of coronavirus. For many colleges and universities, that means canceling events and classes, closing dorms, and dramatically disrupting the lives of students and faculty. In the United States so far, 1,102 colleges and universities have closed their campuses due to coronavirus, choosing to move classes online. Georgetown professor Brian Alexander estimates that college closures have impacted over 14 million students so far.
Sandy Rios with you. That was a CNBC report about what you know, and that is that the coronavirus is affecting everything in America, including higher education. Many of you probably have college students who are home working at their computers or just hanging out, and many of you are college students just hanging out wondering, you know, if you'll be able to get a job. Some of you are in maybe working on elevated degrees, and you're wondering if there'll be a place for you in colleges and universities. Certainly, we've talked enough about the corruption in the universities, about the loss of free speech, about how they have treated conservatives, et cetera, et cetera. So the question, you know, is, I think, for many of us, if the coronavirus shutdown of these colleges and universities is a good thing or a bad thing. Well, I can't think of anyone more equipped to answer that question, and we'll ask a lot more complex questions than that, than my next guest. The National Association of Scholars, you've heard me speak about many, many times. It's an independent membership association of academics and others working to sustain the tradition of reasoned scholarship and civil debate in America's colleges and universities. The NAS upholds standards of a liberal arts education that fosters intellectual freedom, searches for the truth, and promotes virtuous citizenship. And the president of the National Association of Scholars is Peter Wood, who joins me this morning. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Peter, let me just say that you have been working on a very, I think, exhaustive list of recommendations to the president, to Congress, both houses of it, on what can be done to maybe use this particular coronavirus crisis, shutdown, whatever you want to call it, to sort of inject, maybe turn back colleges and universities to their initial missions when they were founded, like back in the 1800s. Can you give us an idea? This document is coming out just this week, and if it should be embraced, kind of just give us a general idea of what your goal would be. I said it kind of awkwardly, but what are you trying to say to them that you want to change?
Well, we're trying to restore what's best in American higher education and take this opportunity that is presented by the shutdown and by the financial crisis and by the enrollment crisis, which are all part of one big mess, to see if we can make changes that the American people need, including college students who are going to be hard hit by this current situation. So I think the headline of our piece is that we're calling for a 50% reduction in administrative expenses in colleges and universities. If that were done, it would, in a stroke, wipe away many of the things which have been driving up tuitions to astronomical levels, that have put students behind the eight ball with a massive student debt. and that have diverted American higher education from being an institution dedicated to real education to being a place where indoctrination in progressive ideology tends to be dominant.
So, okay, that's great. Listen, that gives people a taste right there. And I want to get into that in more detail, because you have a lot of suggestions that are on the financial side, but they're just common sense. I mean, that's what I think always impresses me about you, Peter. You have so much common sense, and yet you are a scholar. You are a scholar yourself and former professor. I know that we talk often, maybe not you and I personally, but I certainly discuss it because it's impacted my life. I lived through the time of turmoil in American universities. I actually, thank God, I graduated when they were still good, and I had a really great education. And I talk in general about the takeover of, the hippies of my generation, of academia. So, you know, this whole notion that they cut their hair and they ran for Congress and they cut their hair, or some of them let it grow longer, and they went into colleges and universities. How well-founded is that accusation? Did they do that, really?
Oh, yes. Like you, I lived through it, but I lived through it longer than you, since I was a college professor for a quarter of a century. The effect of this was that a monoculture developed in higher education, where if you weren't on the left, you were going to be excluded. You might try to hide and pretend that you're just going to focus on your specialization, but increasingly that became impossible. The desire to hide from the demands of the ideologues became much harder, and in these days it's really hard. I'm head of an organization that enrolls academics. I hear almost weekly from people who say, I really support what you do, I like what NAS does, but I don't dare join you, it would be a career killer for me. So there's this palpable fear among academics who consider themselves conservative or traditionalist, and to a somewhat lesser extent, libertarian, but all of them see this as a world in which they must operate by the rules of the left, and that is directly traceable to this the phenomena of tenured radicals that you were referring to, the people who moved into graduate school to escape the draft when that was a possibility, and then stayed on to become professors during the time when American higher education was booming and the whole baby boom generation was enrolling in college. So the opportunities for teaching positions were abundant. The standards were fairly lax. And what we ended up with was an institution that is now almost completely dominated by people on the left. Now, when I say that sort of thing, people say, well, what about the economics department? What about the business school? Well, even there, we might find that in areas like the economics department, only one out of 10 people are conservative, but that's way better than it is in the anthropology department, where it's 10 out of 10 are liberal. So we are in a position now where you can't really exaggerate the degree to which progressive leftism is the dominant ideology on campus, and it has a zero tolerance for people who disagree.
You know, you can say that now, and I think people don't go, oh, surely not. I think most people would say, yes, we've seen that on the news. We've watched what's happened with students and all of this. And I'm thinking, you know, Peter, about that, the notion of the far left, that they strategize and plan, and they plan for decades out. We know this. They organize and they plan and they plot and they plan. And they have a scheme, or one of the phrases that they have always adopted, at least in the West, the Western left. I'd say Western communists, I could say that. The march to the institutions. And they have strategically marched through, I think, without exception, every institution. They're now marching through church hierarchies. And maybe they're the last holdouts. The whole idea, from my understanding, is to take control of the professional or the top or the executives, the not the grassroots, as it were, not just the membership, not just the, and now in the case of academia, not just professors, but the administrators. And so when you can do that, then you can, you know, then you can wag the dog big time, because you actually have control. And we have seen them do that in, you know, whether it's the American Library Association. They were doing horrible things a couple of decades ago, things that were unmentionable, that librarians would, old librarians, traditional librarians would have had a fit. We've seen them do that in medical societies, in the American Bar Association, and I could go on and on. And so I'm assuming that that's the same approach and strategy they used in American higher education. True?
It is true. And in this case, we have sort of the master planning document, which was written in 1962, I think it was, the Port Huron Statement, which laid out the plan for taking over higher education. And they were quite deliberative about it. The idea was that there's a college or university in every major city and in many places all around the country, all 50 states, and people have no choice. If they want to get ahead in American life, they think a college education is necessary. So it was seen as an institution that was ripe for taking over. You get hold of this institution, you can train the next generation and the generation after that in seeing things the way you see it and nobody else does, and you have saturation across the country. So you find that nowadays, even in the deepest red states, there's a state university someplace that shows up on the map as being bright red. So we are in a world where the faculty and increasingly the students and the graduates of these programs see the world through the lens that was created by the Port Huron Statement in the early 1960s. That's the radical game plan, and it's still in play.
And I was reading further down in your document that, I'm sorry you don't have it in front of me, but you can help me, I'm sure. There is a body, an international body that grades colleges and universities of the learning of students, the students that come out, and their quality of learning and critical thinking and all of that, and America has just plunged. Can you say something about that?
Well, yes. There is a set of international standards that get called into play with tests every 5 years or so. It's run by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. It rates the U.S. currently as lagging way behind in science, reading, and math. That's the most recent figures there, I think, are from 2016. There's something called the Collegiate Learning Assessment, which measures advances in critical thinking over the course of a four-year education. So they test people coming in and they test them going out. And what they've now found is that about 40% of the students who attend colleges come out at the end with no advance at all in critical thinking, zero. About another third make a marginal increase. So we're talking about our whole higher education system is working well for about 20% of the students who attend. It's just heartbreaking.
And their kids, so they can't, you're supposed to go to university so that you can learn how to think critically. You know, so they can't think critically. They don't know the basics. I've heard Wheaton College is my son's alma mater, and I've talked to professors there who say that their kids, who are supposed to be the cream of the crop, can't do grammar, can't spell properly. Standards have lowered so much, and that is what the left has done. The colleges and universities, and yet your kids know all about transgender studies, women's studies. It is a bizarre time. And now the coronavirus is causing colleges and universities to close, to shut down, to send students home. Is this an opportunity for change? Well, the National Association for Scholars believes it is. And when we return, I want Peter to, this is an amazing, these suggestions that they're going to be making to the president and also to Congress. So stay tuned. Sandy Rios in the morning, AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
The sign of what's to come for other financially cash-strapped institutions and a glimpse at the impact it could have on cities and towns across America where schools are the main economic driver. The vote would permanently close three Vermont State College campuses because of COVID-19. Chancellor Jeb Spaulding said the schools were already in financial trouble from declining enrollment, revenues, and competition, but the pandemic prompted the refund of more than $5 million to students for room and board, rounding out a $12 million budget deficit. If the closure is approved, 500 faculty will be laid off and 2,000 students will have to make other plans for school this fall. Critics say the ripple effect will be devastating, eliminating a huge employer in the region and shutting off the engine that keeps small businesses afloat. And not bailing out the schools will hurt the state's ability to attract students from both in and out of state.
It says to them, you know, don't bother coming here. Don't even bother applying. It's just over. This is a tremendous impact for all of us. And every small town in America that is facing this situation should understand that academia is the engine of what drives all of our economies.
Experts say Vermont is likely the tip of the iceberg. According to one study, 60% of colleges missed their enrollment goals last fall, and 30% have been operating at a deficit. Problems are most likely for small liberal arts schools, religious institutions, and rural schools with low enrollment. And many of these schools are in small towns across America, which would be economically crushed.
A large number of schools, particularly in New England and the Midwest, that are on the shakiest ground. And so you'll see actually any school under 1,000 students in particular that doesn't have a strong brand have a tough go of it in the weeks and months ahead leading into the fall. And then we'll get a clearer indication of where schools are.
Experts say this discussion is likely to come to state legislatures across the country as they grapple with whether to bail out institutions that keep their economies running amid a potential flood of bankruptcies.
Hi, that was Jackie Heinrich of Fox News. Just a week or so ago, I heard that report, and I certainly thought of all the colleges and universities and campuses I've seen around the country. I think of Wheaton, where my son went, and that's the town I actually raised him in. I lived in for 20 years. I consider that my hometown, and I think of the campus there, and I thought of the campuses around the country that you can envision, your local community college or your university, and how it affects the community and how much a part it is of it. And so the shutdowns are affecting all of us, including our students. Well, is this a good thing or a bad thing? Given all that Peter Wood and I have just been talking about, Peter, again, is the president of the National Association of Scholars, and so as they often do, the National Association of Scholars has taken this opportunity to create a template, a suggestion, more than suggestions, suggestions by people who are in the know about what's wrong at colleges and universities to present to Congress, both houses, and the president. I am a fan, big time. Let me just tell you, National Association of Scholars is the organization that was responsible for fanning the flames, I mean in a good way, on the Confucius Institutes, which were overtaking colleges and universities, infiltrating campuses around this country with communist-associated students who were stealing secrets, taking information, and infusing American college students with communist ideals. It's just an amazing thing we let it get that far, but it was the National Association of Scholars who alerted the nation to that. And so here they come again with this critical care policy recommendations to restore American higher education after the shutdown. Okay, so Peter, let's just walk this down. We can't talk about all of it. You started out earlier by talking about just the economics because they're talking about another stimulus, and you and I both know that colleges and universities already have been paid quite a bit. Harvard made news receiving quite a bit, and we could talk about that in a second. In fact, we could start with that. As a matter of fact, you say that there should be no bailout for wealthy colleges. Well, why not? They're going to lose funds too. What's your problem with that, Peter?
Well, when you say wealthy colleges, we're talking about the 100 private universities with the largest endowments. Harvard's endowment is just shy of $41 billion. It can manage its way through any kind of setbacks caused by the coronavirus without a penny of taxpayer support. And the same holds true of other universities that aren't in the $41 billion range that actually do have endowments in the billions of dollars, sometimes tens of billions of dollars. So, first of all, there's just no need to be spending public money to support organizations that are perfectly capable of taking care of themselves. Their endowments are rainy day funds. Well, now we have a deluge, and they should be spending the money that they have to support themselves during that period of hardship, if they're going to experience any hardship at all. The reason that I'm focusing on the economic side of this is that the economics of American higher education right now are in a catastrophic position. Even before the coronavirus came along, the colleges and universities were not meeting their enrollment targets. In your intro material just now, it mentioned some of that. Most colleges and universities this year are missing their enrollment targets. The significance of that is that most colleges and universities are dependent on their tuition, room, and board income to meet their operational expenses. They don't have endowments to fall back on. That means they're going to be in a deficit position, and they can't stay there very long. They need to do several things. One is to cut costs, and they are cutting costs in marginal ways. The other thing is that they're expecting the government to step in and bail them out. That's where we have the opportunity. I think we can leverage any potential bailout coming from the government on colleges and universities doing things that they should have done long before now, but are either reluctant to do or find it politically impossible to proceed in. So we are now in an era in which a great deal of higher education is taking place at a distance, online, in various forms. That means that the students aren't on campus. So why do we need legions of diversity deans, psychological counselors, people whose whole job it is to hold the hands of the students and make them feel good in their fragility? Well, their fragility now is in their parents' basement, and those employees hired by the universities at inordinate expense are the very people who are now rendered unnecessary. Now, of course, the colleges and universities want to get back to business as usual. Business as usual, the status quo ante, the way things were going a year ago. We can't allow that. We cannot allow our universities to go back to the shambles that they've made themselves into. We need to refocus the reason we have colleges and universities in the first place. It is to create American citizens who are knowledgeable, independent, capable of managing for themselves in life and not becoming clients of a political party or of the state. We are right now training people to be clients rather than to be independent, self-sufficient people. So I think the opportunity that's at hand is to call universities back to their primary mission or what their primary missions were before the left took over. Now, I see this as a huge fight because the last thing that a university is willing to say goodbye to are the 60 people working in the diversity office who provide no net academic good to the students of the university at all, but make the administrators feel self-righteous and empowered that they're doing the right thing to advance social justice. Well, they're not. What they're advancing is a pernicious ideology that is bringing America low. The purpose of our 50 or so recommendations is to call the university back to its guiding principles. We think that that can be done because suddenly the American people have leverage that they didn't have before. We've been faced with this situation now for decades in which parents think they have no real choice but to send their students to the best colleges they can get into. Well, the best college you can get into right now is one that has a really good online program. The world in which we're operating has changed. Higher education understands that. They're deathly afraid of it. That's why they think that getting bailout money from the government is the best way for them to go. In the meantime, they've done things like call for salary freezes. They've done furloughs or layoffs of some of their employees. They've put limits on their purchasing accounts. A few of them have taken cuts in administrative salaries, but for the most part, these aren't serious proposals or serious actions that will get them out of the financial hole they're in. The American Council of Education, ACE, is sort of the higher education establishment voice, ACE is expecting enrollment declines this fall of at least 15%. Probably going to be more than that, but that's their minimalizing claim. A 15% loss in students, if it is just that, is going to push dozens, if not hundreds, of colleges and universities into bankruptcy. They can't sustain that. The ones that are most vulnerable are indeed ones with enrollments of fewer than 1,000. We make some exception for that. We're calling for a 50% reduction in the administrative expenses at universities. Larger than that, for those that are smaller, we say 10%. We understand their fragility. It's not our purpose to drive places into bankruptcy, but I think it's not in the American national interest to try to preserve every institution that has been mismanaged or has directed itself towards trying to bring the American people to a state of deep dependency.
Peter, let me just interject, just to make it really clear. You're recommending all this and a whole lot more be requirements of receiving federal bailouts. And you feel fairly certain, because of all the things you just said, the lowering of the enrollment, plus the coronavirus, the loss of tuition, housing income from students, et cetera, that there are going to probably have to be federal bailouts. There already have been. In fact, I don't want to dwell on this, but you mentioned Harvard. Harvard actually got millions of dollars in American dollar bailouts a few weeks ago with their $41 billion endowment. And it was like a twist. It was like they had to be called out several times, even by the president, to get them to return it. But they did return it eventually. But the point is,
that was a $9 million bailout, which they tried to hold on to, but couldn't. Yes.
Yeah. So the point is, if colleges and universities are going to be taking taxpayer dollars, there should be some strings attached. And this might be an opportunity to, in attaching the right strings, to turn this, what's become an American nightmare, I think, around. We've already seen the results of having our kids educated, so-called educated, in these dreadful, horrific institutions, including Harvard and Yale. They've all just turned out kids who end up turning against their parents, turning against their country. Now, there are exceptions. I'm painting a very broad brush. I recognize that, but it's a pretty accurate brush from what I've seen with my own eyes. And it's time to set that straight. And the National Association for Scholars is releasing this document. Again, it's called it is called Critical Care. And it means of a time to just kind of step in and use this opportunity, since the left is so often using opportunities. This is our opportunity to inject some common sense into the higher education situation. Now, Peter, if you just said, and you said it, let me repeat it again. You don't think there should be a bailout for administrators, and that they should be. That is the problem. I mean, it's like 100 principals and 2 teachers, right? I mean, I'm exaggerating, but it's just out of balance the number of people who are paid administrative salaries, right?
It's way out of balance. Right now, there are more administrators than teachers. It's not 2-to-1, but it's over 50% of the salary expenses of universities go to administrators. Way to understand this is that 20-some years ago, that was exactly the opposite. There were twice as many faculty as administrators. And go 40 years ago, it was about 4 times as many faculty as administrators. So what's changed in the last 20 years that we suddenly need a huge collection of officers and so few soldiers? The world of administration has quadrupled in size from what it was 40 years ago. Why is that? Well, a lot of it has to do with the commitments to diversity, multiculturalism, service learning, a kind of grab bag of social justice programs, each of which requires its own top administrator and then sub-administrator and staff to run it. This is where the money goes. If you're going to college to get a degree in biology, you may not need to have 50 administrators tending to your every ache, but you're going to get them anyway. This changes in a fundamental way when you send the students home and say, it's too dangerous to be on campus, you'll catch a virus or be vulnerable, so we're going to send you home and you're going to get your courses online. The students discover and their parents discover that the heart of education is still instruction, and that instruction can be done perfectly well without any of this folderol. I think that brings the point home to parents. A lot of those students are going to say, if this is all I have to do to get a college degree, count me in. I'm going to
stay home,
my degree online.
Let me just quickly wrap this particular part of this up, because you also think that there should be encouragement to give payroll support to faculty and community colleges, vocational education to support that, and also encourage low tuition, which brings me to the thing I want to talk about next, Peter, and that's just the quandary for students who end up with these incredible loans. It's just gotten so twisted. And so when we come back, again, we're talking with Peter Wood of National Association for Scholars, and we'll put this document on our Facebook page so that you can read it. It's called Critical Care, and it's fascinating because it's just common sense. It's really good stuff, and you can share it with others and share it with your colleges and universities, your professors, your congressmen, your senators. Sandy Rios in the Morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the Morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
It's a scandal to me that we have trained so many of the Chinese Communist Party's brightest minds to go back to China to compete for our jobs, to take our business, and ultimately to steal our property and design weapons and other devices that can be used against the American people. So I think we need to take a very hard look at the visas that we give to Chinese nationals to come to the United States to study, especially at the postgraduate level in advanced scientific and technological fields. You know, if Chinese students want to come here and study Shakespeare and the Federalist Papers, that's what they need to learn from America. They don't need to learn quantum computing and artificial intelligence from America.
That was Senator Tom Cotton talking about the part of the problem, shall we say, we're having with China as it relates to colleges and universities. It is stunning, and he is not overstating it. And Peter Wood and his document from National Association for Scholars, has created this document, Critical Care, suggestions, policy recommendations for our congressman and to our president. And it will be presented, it's going to be presented this week. So, Peter, about China, I was shocked when I read in this document that you prepared the percentage of Chinese students in our universities and how they're getting precedence over American students because they're paying full tuition. Can you say something about that?
Well, a third of the international students in American universities come from China. They pay full tuition. Very few American students pay full tuition, and that means they're getting scholarships from their host institutions, discounts in effect. So it turns out that a Chinese student is worth more to a university than an American student. Our taxpayer-funded institutions are serving China better than they're serving the U.S. The universities have become dependent on this source of income. Some of them have developed business models in which they specifically cater to Chinese students, even though they're still supported by U.S. money. The Confucius Institutes are a piece of Chinese foreign policy aimed at ostensibly cultural exchange, but in fact they are places that engage in espionage and subversion of U.S. interests. So there's the problem of Chinese students taking back expertise that we really should be holding close in the national interest, but there's also the problem of our institutions being derailed, being subverted into being agents of a hostile foreign power. Then there is this business that China calls its Thousand Talents Program, which is this surreptitious activity of suborning American academics, usually in high-tech and advanced science fields, paying them lots of money off books. The host institution knows nothing about it. Recently, we had the head of the biology department at Harvard caught out in having worked with the Wuhan University, of all places, in his own area of expertise, which included viruses. He got fired for that. But the Thousand Talents program has at least 1,000 American academics, most of them unidentified. So China is a serious problem in American higher education. When I have floated this document around to fellow academics, some of them shudder at the idea of losing the ability to draw Chinese students. They're the ones that are bread and butter now. They pay the bills. They come in. How could we turn our backs on that? Well, we have to. We have an American national interest in this, in making sure that our universities serve the United States and not the Communist Party of China.
Let me give you a real-world observation about that, Peter. I'm from Illinois. That's my home state. University of Illinois was probably, besides University of Chicago, one of the highest, one of the hardest to get into, the highest academically rigorous. When I was growing up, it was a plum to get into the University of Illinois. A lot of engineering students, a lot of talent came out of that school. So my husband went to law school there, and we were driving through a few years ago. It's probably been 10 years ago. And we drove through the campus, and we were both stunned that we saw Chinese and East Asian students just, that's pretty much all we saw. We hardly saw any American students. We have friends that had, they were like third generation University of Illinois, and their children had performed very well, great credentials, who could not get in the school. So I'm just saying, real world, this is what's happening. I've heard the same thing. I'm going to even mention a name, University of Texas. I knew of a student who graduated there, and the graduation, now this is anecdotal. The graduation class was just hardly any native-born Americans. So it's really happening. I'm sure I don't have to convince people. And that's part of what you're saying. And I also, on the Chinese students, I know that you know, Peter, that the Chinese government, communist government, requires its students to spy. And that's just part of the agreement. They come to our universities, and they are to send back anything relevant that would help the government. And so there's a good reason why that's one of the things that you limit. Also, then, when you talk about American students and the finances, like the loans and the college aid, what are the proposals? At least give us an idea of what you're trying to change in that arena.
Well, we're trying, for one thing, to make sure that colleges and universities that accept the loans have skin in the game. When a student can't repay and is effectually bankrupt, although these loans cannot be discharged in bankruptcy under current law, the university goes scot-free. That is, they admit students who aren't really qualified for their program. Sometimes they're severely unqualified. The students take out loans from the federal government. The money goes into the coffers of the university. The student fails after a semester or two. The university keeps the money. The student goes away with debt. Some students soldier on and complete their programs in degree areas where there are no job opportunities. They end up languishing for a decade or more in marginal occupations. And for that, they have a debt burden. The average debt burden is about $35,000. Some of them have multiples of that in debt, which they are never going to repay. That debt is going to hang around their next like a noose for the rest of their lives. So part of what we're proposing here is let's deal with the immediate situation, which is that the massive unemployment caused by the shutdown is going to mean that very few students are in a position to pay on their loans for the coming year. So we think a moratorium on debt repayment until January of 2021 is a good idea, free student loan repayments. That doesn't mean injuring the banks. There are about 7% of student loans come from banks. The other 93% comes from the federal government. So the government should just suck it up for the rest of this year, because nobody's going to be able to repay anyway, or very few. We are also looking to tie participation in a further bailout with an agreement from the universities that they mount some kind of student loan buyback program. few of them already have, and that's a great idea. The idea here would be that we simply transfer the indebtedness of people who aren't able to repay back to institutions that are able to repay. The question of what to do with the massive student debt that's up there isn't fully. Americans owe about $1.5 trillion in student loans.
Oh.
That, think of this as money that's gone into the hands of colleges and universities, and they've already spent it. Spent it doing what? The $1.5 trillion improvement in higher education that we've seen in the last 20 years? I don't see that improvement. That's money that's gone down the rat hole. So there's a good issue here that we should be looking at some way of allowing students to escape some of this debt. Maybe we reinstitute a limited form of bankruptcy for students who can't pay if they're in a marginal occupation 7 years after graduation. Maybe they're just not ever going to be able to repay, and we're fooling ourselves by holding that as good debt on our national books. Finding a way to retire it without creating moral hazard, that is encouraging other people to be deadbeats, is a hard problem, but I think we need to wrestle with that.
Yeah.
I would like to hold colleges and universities responsible for 30% of all defaulted student loans. The effect of that will make colleges and universities a lot more careful about to whom,
yes,
whom they admit.
Exactly. So that those are great ideas, and we just touched on them. But I do want us to get to this whole notion of supporting American principles. And I would love to know, we already know what they're doing wrong. What are you suggesting they do right?
Well, I think that they should sign something that I'm calling an intellectual freedom charter and put it into their bylaws. This would be a guarantee of actual intellectual freedom on campuses, something that's woefully absent right now. And we've written out such a charter. No doubt it could be amended and adapted in various ways. But the basic idea is that we want campuses to be places where the administration does not take political positions, that faculty and students are free to discuss any issue in a responsible way, and that there are no punishments and there's no sort of set of organized spies to identify people who are professing the wrong opinions or using the wrong pronouns or something like that. We're also calling for a restoration of due process. This is to some degree underway with Secretary DeVos's efforts to roll back the Obama-era changes in Title IX, but this is a situation right now. If an individual is accused of sexual harassment or sexual assault.
Oh, Peter, we're losing you.
So on. Okay.
Peter, we just lost you for a second. Your phone's dropping out. Let me just jump in to say some of the other things that you are suggesting is prohibiting illegal aliens from being, you know, students at a university. You also have in this document a way to force colleges and universities to comply. If they're going to take federal bailout money, there will be audits and there will be a legal recourse from students if they don't comply and other things like that. It is very thorough, and it is, again, being introduced this week. Now, Peter, who do you hope sees this? And do you think that you will get, I'm sure there's going to be some sympathy for this. It's sympathy, interest, I mean, harmony with a lot of the congressmen. Do you have some that are already on board with you on this?
We've been rushing this, and we have not taken the time, unfortunately, to develop a core of support in Congress over this. I'm hoping that someone like Tom Cotton will find it very convincing. We do need to find political leaders who will endorse it. I'm hoping that President Trump will read it and find it attractive, but I'm hoping that we will attract support on both sides of the aisle, as unlikely as that might sound. But we've tried hard to be apolitical in the sense that we're not using this to promote some ideology of our own. We're trying to say, let's get universities back to the business of education. Let's put students first. Let's make sure that faculty are well treated and that the university is not a place that simply is the play box of or sandbox of the administrators. we think the right to private action, whereby students can sue their universities for noncompliance, would be a crucial element in making this document that isn't a dead letter on its arrival. There have to be consequences for those who sign up and then don't do what they said they were going to do. So,
if you didn't make any inroads at all with this document, and I'm going to do everything I can to help you make inroads, but let's just say the thing stays as it is. Colleges and universities are becoming insolvent. There's going to be, as you said, a 15% lower enrollment. Might be worse. Might be more than that. It depends on how the virus shutdown plays out. But how do you see this naturally playing out? It seems, well, there's the music. So just quickly, if you can, 30 seconds on that. If this doesn't go, if your suggestions aren't taken, what's going to be the natural out unfolding here?
The closure of about 20% of American colleges and universities that will be financially unsustainable without a bailout of some significant nature and a bailout tied to these kinds of corrective actions.
Wow, very good. Peter Wood, thank you. National Association of Scholars, I can't say enough about them. I belong. I'm not an academic, but I think I have my PhD in news and commentary. But this new document they produced is called Critical Care Policy Recommendations to Restore American Higher Education, and we will put that on our Facebook page. So thank you, Peter, always, for your great work. And we just hope that this will take root and the president will see it and something will happen. Sandy Rios, in the morning on AFR Talk.